Dr. Coots, what is your quest?
My quest is to go to heaven. Apart from that, I guess there are other things that you would want to pursue, but I guess I have those too, but generally that's the idea. That's where I'm directing my family. That's why I got into the line of work that I do. I don't think finally anything else is going to be satisfying. So that's why I have aimed everything at that.
I think you got to define go to heaven in this context here.
Yeah. Attain paradise, have the blessed vision of Christ in glory. These are all things that I'm aiming for. I don't know if heaven includes golf or fly fishing, but if it did, that would be a nice bonus. But what we're talking about finally is seeing and being in glory.
What's glory?
Glory is the nearer presence of God in a way that man does not currently have access to in any kind of ready or clear or continuous way. So if we attain some kind of, you know, foretaste, the way we talk about the Lord's Supper being, it really is just a foretaste, because the people gathered there are gathering with so much and always leave with so much that is dark and sad. And that's all part of the ministry of the church, is that you are ministering to those who inhabit darkness and sadness too. Sometimes throughout their lives, more often now and then. But glory is all of those things, all of that peace and rest in Christ, but without the sadness and the darkness anymore.
Okay, loving it. Back to the first question with a little more narrow scope, you know, assuming Christianity and your pastorate and your fatherhood all are taking priority. Like, it's more like, what is your quest? Like, how are you going to achieve this now here? Talk about it. Share. What are you after?
The reason I find that difficult to do is because I have never sought to be highly self-conscious. I wasn't raised that way, and I have never found it terribly productive to be highly self-conscious about everything. And I don't mean self-conscious just in the nervous sense. I mean self-conscious in the sense that is ubiquitous on social media, where people are incessantly promoting themselves so that they turn into like a brand version of themselves. I try to have as little not just conflict, but you know, levels in my life between who I am in various settings. And everyone has levels. I am different with my friends than I am in front of, you know, 600 people I don't know. Obviously, that's the way anyone is. But I have tried to minimize those things. There's a Latin phrase that's used sometimes, like it's on family mottos and this kind of thing. And it's esse quam videre. And it's one reason that I hate video. Esse, to be rather than to seem. And to seem, videre, is also has to do with being seen. So both S-E-E-M and S-E-E-N in English. And I've tried to minimize as much as people can, because hypocrisy is like an inborn root in human beings. But I've tried to minimize the difference between what is seen and what actually is as much as I possibly can. So being self-conscious about my life, or my life being somehow other people's source of fascination or something like that, I really have tried to minimize. And the reason, I mean, part of that too, no, I was raised that way, but part of that too is I don't actually think that the amount of things that other people need to think about or imitate in other human beings is really that large. the things that need to be imitated generally are readily seen, and people can, if they want to, see those in my life, if they have some access to that. But it's not the kind of thing that I think Instagram is capable of, or any other platform that is going to make one's own life visible. I suppose I could take pictures and stuff anytime I go somewhere and show where I am and what I'm doing, and that, you know, I am trying to foster missions in the United States of America, or I am trying to talk about marriage or whatever it is. I guess I could do that.
That was what I was after with the question, just for the
well,
show.
Yeah.
I'm loving the answer. I'm loving the answer. Please keep
going. And here's why I don't do that. Number one, because I would never get over the sense that it was desperately fake on some level. That it's all me and what I'm doing, and, you know, finally Jesus doesn't care, so I'm not going to try to make other people care right now. You know, I think that when you're doing things, even for the sake of the kingdom of God, you have to remember that if you get everything done, you still are supposed to say that you're an unprofitable servant. So, you know, I've only done what I was asked, right? There are other ways to think about work in the kingdom of God. The parable of the talents is another one. But that self-consciousness is about, look at what I'm doing and look at what's happening and look at the great things that are going on, is characteristic of the goats in the parable of the sheep and the goats. They're like, well, when didn't we do all this stuff? And the guy who only has one talent and buries it has the longest explanation of what he did in the time when the master was in the far country. So, you know, I try to just do what is in front of me in that way. And so that means thinking about one's life, I think, a little more lightly than people. I find the trend is for people to be extremely self-serious. Here is their big thing that they're doing. Here is their passion. Here is their whatever. And I have no objection to passion and no objection to people caring about things or doing things. I mean, there's an epidemic of people being too cool to do anything, you know, that. So I have no objection with people trying to accomplish things in their lives, but taking it terribly seriously, the way that images of oneself, both produced and then replicated over and over and over again, doing those things or about those things, that really doesn't line up with the way that you should think about where you are and what you're doing, which is with a lightness people tend not to have. So, you know, I mean, you can look at the Israelite kings if you want a biblical example. You can look conversely at the apostles. And obviously I'm trying to take the method of the apostles, which is to take what I am doing with a certain lightness. And what I mean by that is, when things have glory, they are in Hebrew literally weighty. Weight and glory are connected in Hebrew, and that's a fun thing, and just one more reason to learn Hebrew if you don't know it, because Hebrew being, as we talked about, almost caveman talk compared to Greek, has fewer words, so the concepts are more directly connected than they are even in Greek, let alone in English. When things have glory, they're weighty. And for a Christian, everything else that isn't the attainment of the resurrection call of God in Christ Jesus, this is in Philippians, is, you know, it can go into the sewer. That's where it can go. Ultimately, it can go into the sewer. So when you're thinking about things that you're doing, and we have many listeners who are really doing incredible things. I mean, the show functions, I think, as infotainment for a certain percentage of people. And on some level, you know, I don't like that, but I'm glad they're being informed in some manner, even if it's changing nothing about their lives. We have a certain percentage of listeners who are already doing amazing things. And that's part of the reason why they're listening, because they want to hear about other things that are going to help them as they do those things. Whatever you're doing, right, of whatever scope, I think you have to handle it with a certain lightness, because when you handle the things that you're doing with a heaviness, like they are obvious and permanent and are the attainment of eternal glory in paradise, you're going to spend your whole life being eternally upset and surprised when they go away or do not pan out the way that you thought, or were not really the things that you needed to be focused on, as it will take you 5 years or 10 years or whatever to figure out. So I try to take everything I'm doing, however big it is, with that lightness, because you have to be ready not only to be pushed somewhere else, right? Macedonia, whatever Macedonia is for you, right? There's a dream and someone is calling you to come over and help us. But you also have to be ready to just not take it so seriously, because you are not actually the point.
Get driven from town to town by rocks being
thrown
right in the head.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah. And when you're, you know, lying there, you know, half dead, as Paul describes himself several times, you know, he says, we were near to death. We were in fear of death, right? You know, you can think about that as, okay, I'm right where I need to be. And that would be true for an apostle of Christ. There's also something that is a little more common, I find, as a spiritual problem, which is things are not working out the way that people thought that they should work out. And there are various solutions to that, but one of them is this negative solution that I'm taking as we record this morning, which is you need to understand that your plans are very, very light in God's hand. And if they were heavy, then they would be glory and you'd already be in paradise. And I think a lot of people spend their lives until they are pushed otherwise, thinking that they are in some sort of, you know, budget rental car version of paradise. Like, and I don't mean that they're happy. I mean that they're treating the things around them and the realities around them as if they have the same weight and solidity that Christ's rule over heaven and earth has, or that the subordination of the angels and archangels to Christ as his hosts have. You know, I think they think like everything will just go on the way it always has. And that's why this show started when it did, because a lot of people realized that they weren't in, you know, the budget version of paradise. Things will change. Things can change. They can change really drastically. And I, you know, I don't need to wake up every day and do something absolutely different than I did the day before, but I try to treat everything I do. And then I try to, you know, use my phone not to take pictures of myself for that reason, because it's like that just adds weight and weight and weight and weight. And it multiplies the levels of reality and unreality in one's own life. But it also gives what you're doing a weight and a solidity it doesn't need to have.
Expel the idol and cast down the shame is the meaning of the name Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul. I'm going to just defend infotainment for half a second. It's not really the main point at all. But as a guy who kind of made my chops thinking this was the mission field, I'm going to say it still is. I do think that the seed of change in any society is going to be where the conversations are happening, the public market, however that is. And those conversations right now, a large part of modern vernacular is podcasting. I don't listen to podcasts anymore.
Right.
So rarely.
Right. Yep.
I just don't
got
the time to like think about what that guy thinks. I'm trying to think about what I'm thinking right now.
Yeah.
But that said, that's the result of change that happens slowly in me over time. I can think back to, you know, 4 hours of World of Warcraft, three nights a week, you know, and I can see how, you know, as a grown man, that was just folly, really. I mean, it could borderline on evil. I wasn't fixing things anyway. infotainment. So here we are now with this capacity to talk to y'all because y'all want to listen to us for some reason or other. And for some of you, you're just on the very cusp of really doing something. And that thing you're going to do, that decision you're going to make, it's not going to be huge. It's not going to be starting some institution. It's going to be a small change that then begins to, over time, build into a great difference in your marriage, in your kids' lives, your congregation's life. And so I see this as, I mean, it's an advertisement. Absolutely. It's the medium of conversation right now is advertisement. Do I like that? No. No, I hate that. But that's the level of babble we've descended into. And as I say, everywhere I can, stop watching, start reading, take some notes, or we're getting worse. So I'm on it and with you. And if you're listening to this show just for the sake of it, and you're not doing something in your world, let me tell you what to make a decision to do that'll change everything. Take some notes. Take some notes on the show. Sit there with a piece of paper. Write down three things. Focus not on, wow, that was a neat date, but focus on instead, like, oh, I could do that right now.
Yeah.
Like whenever that comes up, just write that thing down. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I'm gonna put my foot right in it and then step out and let you, Dr. Koontz, actually clean up the mess. But there was a, in the world of Twitter that they call X, and God preserve Elon Musk's integrity if he has it, there was a little battle yesterday between a friend of mine, Brian Wolfmuller, and a guy who's made some chops for himself. You know, Stone Choir is kind of known for that. And he just loves attention. So I'm not going to say his name. But the spat was over what I think comes down to the meaning of the word nation.
Okay.
And I know what I think a nation is in English because I live here. I use the word. I preach. I teach. I know what people can hear. I know what they can't hear. I do all the time. I make my chops telling people, think like this. And they go, oh, that does make sense. So I think I know what a nation is. But I would like to know what you would say the standard definition of a nation is. And I'm going to caveat this in any, quote, learned political discourse, end quote, and question mark.
The standard definition is very different from what you would be using if you were trying to use a biblical definition, because the modern world works on a legal and financial scale that the ancient world did not. So in the ancient world, and this is common, I mean, the word ostracism is like this too. It's got a very definite ancient definition and a different, related, but different modern definition. Has to do with voting in the ancient world, and it has to do with being mean to people in the modern world. Okay. So nation is similar, but the definitions are very different from each other. Biblically, you get something like this when Paul is talking about he made of one blood the whole human race, the whole human, all human beings, right? Common descent from Adam, right? But then there are nations and they have some manner of common descent and also boundaries. And if you look at the ancient world, you'll realize that unless you're talking about maybe like a steppe tribe, all of those boundaries are tiny, right? They are in many cases something like at the biggest extent and most imaginatively, like all the lands where the Greeks live, which the Greeks call Hellas, which includes, you know, not Greece, but also large parts of what's now Turkey, blah, 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 blah. But maybe you would call that a whole, you would call all of those people a nation, but you wouldn't call, for instance, the slaves who are the vast majority of the population of Sparta in ancient times. You wouldn't, they're not Greeks. They live in Greece, but they're not the same nation. So ancient people have some concept that you would have multiple nations inside the same political boundaries, whatever those political boundaries are. And that gets a little closer, but we're stopping there for ancient purposes. It gets a little closer to the modern definition, where a nation is really defined by the extent of boundaries of various kinds, boundaries of where currency is normal, boundaries of where certain laws are in place, boundaries of where uniformed militaries have control, boundaries of where a certain set of courts have jurisdiction. And that's all defined by procedures and by a very of all kinds.
Language.
Legal language. Well, I don't think it's defined by language, because, for example, Belgium is a really good example of the way that modern nations don't really need to be very connected to older kinds of bonds, like common descent, real or imagined, a common language. Because if enough people just decide that you need to be a country, and you have, in the case of Belgium, historically a shared Roman Catholicism, that's good enough. Conversely, Scandinavian countries have quasi, to some degree, very mutually intelligible languages. The Nordic countries, I'm not talking about Finland. Finland is definitely its own nation, right? Okay. But the others have almost mutually intelligible languages, but they have to be different nations. And they think of themselves as very, very different nations. And going back into the Middle Ages, they have behaved differently. They didn't send Vikings to all the same places. So if nation has to do with both common descent and boundaries, but let me be clear about that. That would mean that, like, for example, there's a country music singer I like, Charles Wesley Godwin, and he's from Monongalia County, West Virginia. Charles Wesley Godwin would, or I'm sorry, it's John Wesley Godwin. I picked the wrong Wesley. He would
Jehoiakim or Jehoiachin, just for the
right, exactly. Yeah, it's hard, right? He would be from my nation, because I'm sure we have shared descent. We're ancestors from the same three counties in northern West Virginia, and probably the same two in southwestern Pennsylvania. Okay. He would be in my nation. You, Pastor Fisk, would not be in my nation, probably. Okay. So this is where the term nation in the ancient sense is somewhat useful. Maybe if you can stretch it to the concept of ethnicity, maybe. But in an American context or a Canadian context, even that concept is a little... ethnicity is not big enough for what you're trying to talk about.
No, but that's where... So the word ethne,
yeah,
which is the Greek word at
for
play
nation,
here,
right. Yeah.
Which is why I'm going to say it's all linguistics. It's always linguistics. Ethne getting translated as nation by Paul here, as Gentiles by all sorts of other places and reasons, a word that is often and is just like the word German, actually, in its action over time and history. I think the most helpful thing you've given here, though, is to say if it defines anything in its use. So I'm talking ethne, the word, and I mean talking in Greek in the Bible, not just one verse. Okay, the word as it's used with the Septuagint, tied to a history that includes understanding Hebrew cognates and the meanings of those words. So you don't just take one verse and one Greek word and change the world with it. You brought it down to shared boundaries. A nation is recognized shared boundaries. Who recognizes it? That's part of the story and why they recognize it. So why do the nations of Norway and Sweden that have, they can talk to each other, but they don't think they are each other, is because their story is that we're not each other, even though we can talk to each other. And yet we can also be in a place like America where we can talk to each other just fine, but because your skin color is one and my skin color is another, now we're at odds, but we're still in the same nation somehow. And that has a lot to do with banking and the state. Yeah. And so the idea that the state and the nation are one, that's kind of the modern thing. Okay. But then you can't just like throw yourself back and remove that meaning of the word nation and try to have logic work as you talk to the world with it. Right. So that's where you're going to as well, I think, right? So the standard definition of nation, the biblical definition of nation, biblically, it is an understanding of shared boundaries that is generally smaller than the state. generally.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, pretty much always. Yeah.
Yeah. And then presently,
yeah,
it is the way we talk about the state that how do we define how these states are governed together? Now we call them nation states. And yet we find that within the nation states, as we use the word nation, there's a lot of other smaller groups and shared boundaries and tribes or whatever.
Right.
So if you get caught in the etymology of one word, you're gonna lose yourself here.
Yeah, and I don't know what happened on Twitter, but I think that whenever you're talking about the nexus between modern politics and anything else, you have to recognize the sheer weirdness of modern life, in the immense expansion of technology that enables control and discussion and melding over enormous distances. That means that when you're talking about something from the ancient world, and ancient runs all the way up through the Renaissance in this way, if you're thinking technologically, if you're thinking about something from the ancient world, your only analogs to what occurs in a modern state, nation hyphen state, significantly, right? Even though it doesn't have to do necessarily with shared birth, it has to do with like police powers and money and stuff, right? Train systems, right? Nation hyphen state is that only in ancient empires of the largest size, Persians, Babylonians, would you find an analog where you had so many different peoples, nations with shared descent and customs and language and food and all this stuff, that if you looked over the United States of America, for example, you would find dozens and maybe even hundreds of nations. You can't really, I mean, Paul is moving around inside an empire that contains multitudes of nations. His understanding of what the state is not related to his understanding of what the nation is. Paul's actually really clear about this, because his nation gives him both the most trouble, but also to some degree the most pride, right? He knows who he is. And I don't think that we would really be arguing about nations or relating them to what we've talked about many times on the show, is race is both a newer concept, but it's also a much higher level concept about shared characteristics of nations, basically, if you want to say it that way. But it's not a specifically biblical concept. And the reason being, Paul doesn't need to find a commonality with all other people whose nation is ultimately from the Levant or from, you know, Western Asia or whatever, because you got the empire, which governs in various ways. And then you've got the nation that he belongs to. And wherever he goes, he's part of that nation. And the people who try to understand empires this way usually find a richer vein to investigate than people who try to understand empires solely according to some other factor. Because what you'll find, we've talked about Albion's seed, I think, all the way back near the beginning of the show. David Hackett Fisher just said, well, what if there were different nations inside the British Isles? Obviously there were. Obviously there are. How did they impact the different regions of the United States differently? Right? America in that way has always been imperial, in the sense that it is not a national project in quite the same way that New Zealand, for example, is not just British, but even overwhelmingly Scottish. Right. So having colonies doesn't mean that you don't have a nation and that you're necessarily an empire. The Greeks as a nation colonized southern Italy. But it means that when you have melding of any kind, and America is from the first, right, not to speak of today, America is from the first a melding of the various nations of Britain combined with French and Dutch and Germans. These are just colonial nations, you might think of, in the founding.
They're all white, right?
They are all white, but that matters, and we've said this before, that concept matters when you're thinking about somebody who is from a nation so distant that he is generally observably different from you. So white doesn't matter if you're saying how are we going to talk about power in the Constitution and where the federal capital should go?
I think it's really key to say that based on your definition, white's not a nation by any stretch.
I don't think it is unless that nation not only it has some kind of shared general common descent from Europe, but also has all of these other characteristics of being a nation.
Right, right. But then they would still be the nation that they are. They might be white as a nation, but that does not make white a nation. And so the concept of white nationalism, you know, if we want to talk linguistics here, it's exposed. What I see here still at work and really important is the breach between English words of the same root that media has, or I don't know, history, Babel has put upon us, so that if I talk and say the word nation to anybody who doesn't listen to this podcast and have this learned definition that we have gained and gleaned today, they will think I am talking about the United States of America, France, Russia. That is what the vernacular uses it to mean. Yet if I were to say to somebody, what's your nationality? They would immediately know what I was talking about. And they say, I'm from this region in this area, you know, and all this stuff. And so what you have is the words themselves, I'm trying to demonstrate, the words themselves are being torn apart from their roots before our eyes. And we have a decision to make. Do we try to stop Babel? Do we try to use the word the way that is supposed to be used? Or do we translate what we're saying in the present every single day without expecting that someday I'm going to come up with the perfect definition and the perfect book that'll last forever, and that even goes for translations of the Bible?
I think this is easiest to see if you take a situation that both doesn't have the same like moral disapproval attached to it the discussion of whites has. Let's just be honest, right? Everyone thinks he's walking on weird ground. Either he is saying things that he knows will outrage many, or he's afraid to say something that makes him sound like a bad person who just irrationally dislikes other people who don't look like him, etc. If you think about the term nation and you try to relate it to the modern nation state of, say, the United States of America, this is easy to see when you talk about something that, you know, obviously you've probably noticed does not have at all the same disapproval that white nationalism does, which is black nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you start talking about black nationalism,
how about Sudanese nationalism? Right.
Well,
now?
Yeah. Somali national. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. Is that you're dealing with a situation which is both much simpler than this question of how does race relate to nation, because your options, as far as it's configured in the United States, are usually two. You're either an American descendant of slavery, ADOS, or your parents or you yourself, or maybe your grandparents, maybe, are African immigrants from the time since the 1960s that has been allowed in any kind of numbers. That gets configured as all black in the United States of America. In things that Pastor Fisk and I are aware of from our own personal life experience, African immigrants and American descendants of slaves, what you might call historic American blacks, generally don't get along. Don't, in this case, in the case that the two cases I'm thinking of that he also knows about, they don't even want to be in the same church building.
Yep.
And so, you know, that
over
that,
strictly ethnic differences,
strictly. Yeah. Ethnic, national. Right. So, I mean, maybe for certain political purposes, they could both configure themselves as we're black nationalists, or we're for all black people so that we can get something we want done or whatever. Right. But in actual fact, their varying nationhood makes them behave very differently to each other, though they are sharing, in this case, a common, in the basic recognized sense of the word, race. So I think that's both interesting, but it's also clear because the options are so much more limited than when you're talking about, here's somebody who is half Irish, half Italian, and he's white, and he's from Montclair, New Jersey, right? What, you know, how exactly is he supposed to think about his nation? Well, I would suggest he's an American. And there is a concept also in anthropology of nations coming into being, ethnogenesis. Americans are not the same thing as Europeans. I mean, I guess you could call me a European hyphen American, but you know, I'm not German, I'm not English, I'm not French, right?
I'm still stuck in the 80s. But,
so these things are complex, partly because modern nation states have moved at such a rate that talking about race remains somewhat easy, especially when someone stands to gain something from it. I mean, when white people say, I'm not white, I'm Irish. I mean, I understand various reasons they might want to say that. Another reason they might want to say that is because if you're Irish, you get to talk about bad things that happened to you. Whereas if you're white, you're the bad thing that happened to other people in the common public school telling of history. So I get that. But the other difficulty here is that things move at such a rate that the formation of nations is always in progress. So it could be that in two generations, people whose certain set of great-grandparents were from Ghana and their other set of great-grandparents were all originally from North Carolina, going all the way back to, 1705, that will just be a nation. But right now it's not quite. And when it's not, people do behave differently toward each other.
So let's just nip it in the bud. Does God oppose the formation of nations?
No. I mean, new nations have formed throughout history. There was a time before there were Englishmen. There was a time before there were Germans as such. There was a time before there was Ghana. That's a recent creation of a nation out of basically actual ethnicities, actual nationalities.
Right. And again, I think this really demonstrates just how fluid a word nation, ethne, if we're going to use
it is.
What a fluid word this is. And to build any kind of position on it outside of, go to the nations and baptize them. I mean, there he pretty much means don't leave anybody out, no matter how weird they are, right? Like they all get to hear his teaching and all this. Outside of that, the word does not play a large role after we get away from the Jews realizing it's not just for them. So there's this whole edge of the early Christian church contemplating, it's not about our blood, no matter what our shared family ties, banking systems, blah, blah, are.
Yeah.
It's about the blood of the guy who rose from the dead and how that changes everything. I want to see if I can turn this. It's some of the same conversation, but a little different. And it's, I'm not sure how to ask it exactly, but it is the notion that, we're talking linguistics, we're talking how people communicate, we're talking infotainment, and the meme is kind of a good picture of how the modern world thinks now. And, I'm not about to go into memeing for the gospel just yet, but the fact is, a lot of people communicate in meme. Emoticon is like a mini meme. Ha, ha. If you grew up in the 90s, you see what I did there. Anyway, emoticons are hieroglyphic. They are a picture-based form of communication.
Yeah.
We are moving away from alphabetics. I think I can understand and say this is bad overall. I can also see where there's much opportunity here. As a linguist, I'm not trying to stop Babel. I'm just trying to speak clearly today, right? So just in that direction, though, the status of the meme in political discourse.
The status of the meme is that is the way that people who are sub-literate, I'm not going to say pre- or post-literate, I'm not going to give them credit for it, and I'm definitely not going to say literate. Memes are the way that people who are sub-literate communicate. And they always have. And using the word hieroglyphic is helpful because you'll recognize that we were already headed there before smartphones cratered our capacity to pay attention. In the idea that the modern world was always full of logos, in the way that largely pre-literate Europe was full of, you know, symbols for pawnbrokers and barbers and stuff like that, so that you didn't have to know how to read to get through daily life. And knowing how to read, and by that I don't mean that, you know, people can't read, you know, the above text and the bottom text on a meme. Of course they still can.
You know, I hearted that message from my moms, and right. Now I feel bad, Dr. Coons.
And then, but what I mean by that is that they cannot do the things that reading is supposed to enable you to do, which is to follow complex ideas, and particularly to let words determine how you construct things, both pictorially but also emotionally in your mind. This is easy to see in certain realms of publishing, is that if you pick up a book today on, I don't know, World War II, something you'll find is that it will be full of really gorgeous pictures and really, really detailed maps, but it will probably be about a third the size of a book on the same topic from 1990. Because the presumption in 1990 was, if I describe where General Patton is doing what, you will follow through the words and do that work that the maps and the pictures are doing for you in your own mind. You don't need a book full of maps and pictures. We're now, I think, many of us operating, and I, you know, whatever reading levels, I don't know if that's real or fake, on, you know, what's a sixth grade level different from a fifth grade level? I'm sure somebody could tell me. But we are operating on essentially a elementary, maybe a middle school level of reading. Most of us, most adults, I'm talking pastors, I'm talking people who use words for a living. And we think it's okay. And the difficulty there is that you lose the capacity to even follow arguments. So this is, you know, for the purposes of what, like, you and I do for a living, this is not the end of the world. I mean, I have started to use recounting biblical stories more often, not just because I know they don't know them, but because it's easier to follow a story than for me to launch into a logical argument. And that's fine. And, you know, I lose zero sleep over doing that. But you will notice that you can learn more quickly, the more literate you are, in the sense that I'm talking about the capacity not only to read, but to understand and follow and ponder arguments, counter arguments, the kinds of uses of logic.
I mean, can I say it this way? It's the capacity to read something that you didn't understand the first time.
Oh,
can you do that?
Yeah, right. Right.
Like, that's all of it right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
You go back, ponder, discover, like, wait a minute here. He said that what? Way back there? I can look over here now. You know, if that's not happening, then you're not reading.
Right.
You're just entertaining yourself again. And so the infotainment kind of edge to this again is, we got the discussion on literacy. I'm totally with you. And then we got kind of where we are. And then what are we really after with the kerygma, right? If I say that. And to define that for the layman, you know, a very, very substantial term, bigger than the word ethne, about what it means to actually talk about Jesus to the world, which pastors must do, but all Christians do.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, you know, your point about infotainment and you, this is how you cut your teeth, as it were, in the interwebs, through the pipes of the internet constructed by Al Gore. That's a meme.
And I laughed.
Right. And it's fine. I mean, that's well taken, because you don't really have an option about where people are unless you are the inventor of the smartphone. You know, that's not something I get to control, or you get to control, or anybody gets to control. But you do have control over how you engage with those things. So, you know, I you know, I'm not trying to give nuanced discussion of the meaning of the word nation on Twitter because I doubt its possibility. You know, I'm happy to put up pictures of, you know, sunrises with Bible verses on them on Facebook in a way that might seem very simple because my unbelieving relatives see that.
Yeah. Because, and I would say you're understanding the medium there. You're understanding that people aren't going there for a brief history of power. They're going there for potentially really bad dopamine addiction reasons.
Yes,
but you
right.
can actually share the word of God anyway.
Right.
In the midst of their dopamine.
Yeah. Right. In the middle of their, you know, they're posting about what they're cooking and what they're doing and, you know, why Trump is like a demon incarnate. I'm just thinking of some of my unbelieving relatives. Here's a nice little sunrise over the mountains meme from the Trinitarian Bible Society about whosoever believeth
nice
shall not perish but have everlasting life. That, you know, that's all I'm trying to do. I'm not providing six paragraphs about what a biblical nation is and how I think in an American sense commonly it probably could be narrowed down to like subregions of certain states. For most people, because that's how most people live. It really doesn't matter. It matters for mission purposes. The nation thing matters a lot for mission purposes. And because of memes, I've been misunderstood as saying, you know, we should only care about preaching to white people, because my point is there are many, many, many nations in the United States of America. And our church thinks that we have reached all white people. So now let's move on to others. And my point is, we haven't gotten to hardly anyone in biblical nation terms. We have not, right? We don't have our fair percentage of people born and raised in northern New England in our church. They're not there. That's a certain nation with its own history, and we have almost nothing to do with it as a church. So for mission purposes, I think the definition of nation, which is the way that usually the Bible is actually just bringing up the topic, matters a lot. It doesn't matter a whole lot for the content, right, of the proclamation. With different nations, you can see that Paul starts in different places, or Peter starts somewhere else with the Jews, his own nation, than he does with others. But yeah, that's all of that is going to be misunderstood. I mean, the problem with being subliterate is not just that I have, you know, some kind of personal disdain for people who think that everything should be in memes. I actually don't. But the problem with being subliterate is that it's kind of it's the linguistic version of losing the capacity to maintain infrastructure.
Yeah. The key, I think, is to recognize the elite must speak down. And so the elite will learn to speak to the illiterate. It is not the job of the illiterate to learn to speak to the elite so that the elite can do his job. It is the elite's job to teach the illiterate to be literate by speaking down to them. And I don't mean that in some sort of like crass or hateful way, but understanding that they do not understand. They can be taught to understand. I want to suggest for anyone who wants to adopt its thinking out there that the word I prefer for nation in my own thinking, I don't even think about the word nation. I don't bother to translate it. It's just when I'm thinking about what's going on in the world and I want to try to understand quickly what ethne is getting at as a term is very useful. And it comes into English in American style amazingly through the Old Testament in the word tribe. Because it flexes in just the right way to be malleable and fit the places where the reference to a nation by, say, St. Paul is. In fact, he'll even say within his tribe, he's got a greater tribe, right? But you can hear it was on Sopranos, the Jews call themselves the tribe, or at least that's what the Jew on the Sopranos did. I'm sorry if that's anti-Semitic me to believe what you told me to believe. But the point is, you know, tribe's a great word for distinguishing shared boundaries that can move between regions, linguistics, and even states, right? As we try to tie it down, like it is real that it is hard to welcome in someone from another tribe. That is real. That is expected. In fact, you would expect if they're from a different tribe, they're going to be very, very different than you. does that mean that there can be no alliances between the tribes? And while we could just jump to intersectionality from right there, but we'll leave politics and the whatnot for another point. To adopt the thinking of, you know, it is possible in the present age to have solid categories that are not memes, that are not just out there to pass by or share or kind of just hope in, but that you can take into your mind and use them to make decisions in the present, right? And it doesn't matter, again, like, are we talking white and black? We can talk tribalism right there. Are we talking, you know, my HOA versus your HOA? We can talk tribalism right there. Just understand that we have shared interests in these shared boundaries. It ties us together. And when others approach a tribe and threaten it, the tribe will respond together, because there's an identity in tribalism. And everybody who's arguing about this, we're looking for identity. And we're going to tell you your identity is in Jesus Christ. That's where your identity is. And as we went at the start of this very same show, from there, vocationally, you end up in a very real battle for, keeping the faith, speaking the truth in the midst of the whirlwind of the lies. And then, if I might apply this finally to the tribe that is the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which is not the tribe that is the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod, which is not the tribe that is the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, and yet look how much we're actually one tribe. You know, kind of in the big picture of things, like what you said at the end there, Dr. Koontz, I just want to refrain it to the world. Like, we haven't tried to reach anybody, really.
Yeah. The idea that that's one tribe in your parlance, or it's one nation or something, is much closer to being the truth than not, despite whatever ecclesial boundaries exist there. If this were some kind of, you know, self-consciously multi-ethnic, you know, church a la the ELCA, is a conglomeration of various origin immigrant ethnicities, or the Roman Catholic Church, it might have a German Catholic parish, an Italian Catholic parish, and an Irish Catholic parish. And those might have to all close and get together now, and they can. But 50 years ago, 75 years ago, they would not do that. They were their own nations, and there has been an ethnogenesis since then. The idea that somehow a bunch of Lutherans who all came from roughly central and eastern Germany at roughly the same time, with some Western Germans thrown in there and some Baltic Germans, maybe for spice or not, that they're not the same and they don't seem to behave in the same ways is crazy to me. I mean, obviously they do. Obviously they are. I can go into most Lutheran churches and feel the same sense of coldness.
I was going to say the same way. I would say fracturing over things that are true, but yeah, not essential to, yeah, dogmatic, you know, life, right?
Right.
And for the record, Pieper distinguishes. Go look it up.
But the coldness is not a function of, you know, I think the Lutheran doctrine of Christ is the warmest possible thing you could communicate. Amen. If you understood what you were saying. But the coldness is a function of the ethnos. And I can feel it whether they're going to let me pray with them or not, you know. So that's something that you really just have to keep in mind. I don't think that national identity or tribal identity are unreal, but I think that you have to look at them biblically as penultimate. To go back to your original question, they're always penultimate. I mean, no one is going to heaven or even deserves anything in his, because he was born to speak a certain language or has a certain descent or something. And I mean, imagine how tiresome that would be if somebody, I mean, and this is what Paul gets sick of with his own nation, but you know, this doesn't exist in my nation, but if everyone, I mean, it's starting to, I mean, I was complaining recently about how Appalachian has come to mean, you know, people from Ohio are claiming to be from Appalachia, for goodness sake. But, you know, I mean, the idea that somehow that's some kind of amazing thing. And
I mean, people from Ohio are from Somalia, though, right? Can we just talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, the idea that somehow that's the real deal, or this is where real America is found. I mean, it's just, it's boring. And it, it's not just boring, it's not real. Because if you actually have a nation, if you aren't some kind of rootless cosmopolitan of some kind, if you actually have a nation, you have a combination, just like with your own parents, of deep appreciation and deep awareness of the failings. That's what it means to have a nation. If you have a nation, a family, you have a deep awareness of what is great about it. And you have a deep, I mean, I never go to Appalachia and think, wow, everyone here paints their houses so nicely. They keep up their properties. So no, it's sloppy. You can tell we have been in the dumps for a long time. It's depressing, right? That's a failing. That's my nation, but that's a failing. So the idea that nation is an ultimate identity in the same sense that the attainment of paradise is an ultimate goal, that's not biblical. And Paul doesn't say that it is. He's actually willing to put everything else aside.
Family, tribe, and kingdom will do the job for most of your conversations. Hey, if you're just out there and thinking about what's going on this week, it's this week, next week. Morgan Stanley has said recently, consider preparing for a U.S. dollar regime shift. And a strong U.S. dollar has been vital, if often overlooked. Bankers are beginning to signal at the top end, but most prepper watchers have been noticing for some time the fiat currency is continuing to stumble. When the bigwigs start selling their stuff, which is what they're starting to do right now, is when you should maybe just have a little extra water and a couple days of food around. Because if things get weird this 2024, people might not just stock up on toilet paper. You know, they might also break out in the violence that they've been seeded for. So again, you know, don't be a fool. You don't need to go buy what are they called? HMR packets or whatever. And spend thousands of dollars on stuff that's going to get effectively go out of date before you're ever going to use it. But it is always wise to have a general emergency preparedness set up of some kind. Again, water, basic food, considering not yourself, but also your unprepared neighbors who might just come knocking. Little beans and rice, they last a long time. We've found canned sardines are very good for you. Also, just so that you know the news is coming, we'll probably try to take these up at some time because you'll force us to consider when the Pope starts speaking about what you should inject yourself with. That happened this week, and there's a solar eclipse coming. Don't be taken by all of the crazy. You're listening to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us, or you would not be here.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable. A college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran. A college that won't take a dime of federal funding. A college that teaches the best of our Western heritage. A college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College. A college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at BlessedSacramentLutheranChurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith, in the beautiful Inland Northwest.